Always the question comes up, what's the test going to look like? We're going to review Wednesday, but let me give you a little clue ahead of time. There'll be about 25 multiple choice questions and about 10 short answers. You may use your notes that you've made over the reading test questions, and you may use the class notes. I'm not so much into memorize, regurgitate, and forget as being able to figure out what to do with it. Fair enough? Because one thing I have learned in my many years of teaching is if you just insist on people memorizing something, it doesn't stay with them. Your brain is marvelously efficient at flushing information you don't feel like you need. So the point is, how do you make it relevant? And most of what I try to do during class is make it relevant, make it meaningful, make it fit somewhere so at least you understand it. So let's get started with the Texas Constitution. Whoops, that's not what I wanted it to do. Come on. There we go. Now, by the way, all constitutions do basically three things, and the textbooks like to put a fourth one in there, and I'm not too sure that it fits, but I'll put it in there because it's in the textbooks. They talk about establishing the legitimacy of governments. An illegitimate government can have a constitution. If people do not give it high marks for being the document that really governs, then the Constitution is nothing more than window dressing. Fair enough? Establishing the institutions and machinery of government, allocating the powers and placing the limits, hey, there she is, Ms. Blackwalter, are the three main things that a Constitution does. Anybody got a problem with that? Caroline, make sense to you? That ought to be familiar. Gosh, isn't that what we talked about in federal government when you took the course? It didn't change, but it was just because we went from the national level to the state level. Is a city charter, later on in the course we'll be talking about local governments, is a city charter really basically the same thing as a city constitution? Yeah. Does it do these three things? Establishes the institution's machinery, allocates the powers, and places the limits. Now, if every state and every local government attempted to do it the same way, then you could just take them off the shelf, couldn't you? But what tends to make the difference is the philosophy which was used when you wrote them. And basically, political theorists break this into two main categories. I'm not sure I like the titles, but I'll go with what they got. Rationalism, as a philosophy which sees people as essentially rational creatures and government as a logical extension. So it's just the basic document, just covers the basics. Sometimes it's called a liberal constitution. I'm not real sure where they come up with that particular concept, but I'm not going to fight them. Fair enough? Now, realism sees people as basically evil. Got a funny story to tell you early in the morning. I made that statement, maybe 20 plus years ago in a class, and I had a young lady on the front row, and what I said is, I said, sees men as basically evil. Now, I was using it in the non-gender specific, maybe I should say, sees people as basically evil, and she said, boy, you got that right. So later I asked her, and it seemed that she had some very unpleasant experiences with various boyfriends and so forth. Government as a means of social control, and the Constitution as a means of controlling government. Sometimes called a statutory constitution because it attempts to put the laws in the Constitution. Now, Ms. Blackwelder, off the top of your head, which of the two do you think the Texas Constitution more closely resembles?
Probably rationalism.
Actually, no. It is almost exactly the polar opposite. It is the third longest state constitution in the country.
Wow.
We say thank God for Arkansas, you know. And it would be the longest if we hadn't, as I'll point out to you toward the end of the class period, just deleted huge sections of it several years ago, and nobody missed it. because it dealt with totally, I won't say irrelevant, but things that were relevant 100 years ago. So the question is, how did we end up getting to that particular point? Well, it has a little bit to do with our history. Texas has been governed by either 6 or 7 constitutions, depending on how you want to look at it. We could take the Constitution of 1824, which is a constitution of Coahuila and Texas, but it was really a Mexican constitution, not a Texas constitution. So the first operative constitution for Texas was the 1836 Republic of Texas Constitution. And we're going to look at each one of these very quickly. Do I want you to memorize the details? No. If this were a detailed course in Texas history, we might spend 2 or 3 weeks looking at them. Been there, done that. But not necessary. Then when Texas becomes a state, it's necessary to draft a constitution for a state, not a nation. 1861, the Confederate Constitution, 1866, the Presidential Reconstruction Constitution, then the Radical Constitution, and then the present one. So let's look at each one of them real quickly. How much of this do you need to memorize? Just the basics, and that's it. Unlike the Federal Constitution, the United States Federal Constitution, the Republic of Texas Constitution called for a unitary form of government, which is to say, there were no counties did not have independent power. And what we're going to see later on when we get to the Texas Constitution is that it also operates on the basis of being a unitary system. Local units of government have no separate independence, like they would in a federal system. Fair enough? Call for a bicameral Congress with an elected president. It had an extremely rationalistic framework. Ms. Blackwelder, you'd be really absolutely accurate if you talk about the Republic of Texas Constitution being a very rational document. It was written in a hurry. It didn't have time to go into a lot of detail. It's a very short document. You could read it in 15 minutes without any problem. It just set up the very basics. It did have some interesting little provisions. Clergy were prohibited from any governmental office. Now, where do you think that came from? Any ideas? Well, under the Mexican Constitution, there was no separation of church and state, and the religious authorities automatically had significant powers and positions in the government. And that did not go over well with the largely Protestant, at that time, Texans. So they put a provision in the Constitution which said, if you want to hold public office and you're a clergyman, you have to resign your position as a clergyman. No state church. End of sentence. We're not going to tax people to support the church. But it made slavery legal. Now, why would we put that in the Constitution of 1836? What was one of the key issues that led to the Texas Revolution? Mexican Constitution outlawed slavery. The economy of Texas at that particular point in time was heavily dependent on slavery. So the Constitution of 1836 legalized slavery. Now there seems to be kind of an interesting, if you read this morning's front page on the Houston Chronicle, there's a small group of people who are trying to get Texas to secede from the Union. Their chances of having any success with that, I would argue, are about the same as mine of growing a new full head of hair that would make Donald Trump look jealous. It ain't gonna happen. Almost from the very beginning, Texans wanted to be a part of the Union. Most of them had, all of them basically, had come from the United States. And they worked very hard. In several elections, they voted overwhelmingly. Hank, Jessica? They voted overwhelmingly to ask for admission. What was the sticking point? Why did the national government not want to have Texas in?
Because of the slave states.
What were the two sticking points?
Because they legalized slavery and...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you, and I don't think they can either.
They legalized slavery and it would...
Slavery was one biggie.
Yeah, because yeah. They would unbalance the slave states.
Large number of the northern states did not want to admit another southern slave state. Now, that eventually was overcome when Iowa and Texas were admitted almost simultaneously to balance each other out. Remember I told you that Texas and Iowa were in some ways sister states, mm-hmm. admitted within a year of each other, and the deal was Iowa, free state, Texas, slave state. But there was another big issue. Ms. Sargent, you got any idea what it is?
No, sir.
Mexico had never completely relinquished its claims on Texas.
So the government didn't want to have anything to do with it.
And Mexico made it real clear that they thought it would be an act of war if the United States annexed Texas. Well, let's see. Did we end up with a conflict with Mexico over the annexation of Texas?
Yeah.
Yeah, called the Mexican-American War, 1846. Sure enough, turned out that probably wasn't a wise decision on the part. It's not real easy to say who started the war with Mexico. If you take Texas history, and I've taught it several times online, Texas argued that the border was the Rio Grande River. And Mexico argued that the border was the Nueces River. The Nueces River. I get Nueces and Natchez sometimes confused in the back of my mind. There's no reason why I should. Nueces River. So when the Americans posted military forces on the northern bank of the Rio Grande, Mexico considered that an act of war and attacked the American forces. So then the president said American troops have been attacked on American soil and declared war on Mexico. Well, it did not end well for Mexico. They not only were defeated, but had to sign the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. Anybody from American history remember what the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo did?
Tired to answer.
Say again?
I said right now I'm too tired to answer.
Right now you're too tired. These hard weekends.
No, my alarm didn't wake.
I know.
Turn on this morning, so.
Teenagers don't wake up early. See, those are one of the things I know you covered in American history, but it didn't have any particular relevance, so it didn't stick with you, right? In addition to losing Texas, Mexico lost what else?
California.
Arizona, Nevada, and California. Yeah, it basically added about one-fourth more territory to the United States, particularly California. Nobody was losing any particular sleep over Nevada and Arizona at that particular point in time. Because New Mexico. New Mexico did hurt Mexico a little bit because that was where the trading was up all the way to Albuquerque. All right, let's keep moving. So we call for a bicameral legislature, an elected governor, lieutenant governor. Then in 1850, we amended the Texas Constitution to add a plural executive into it, where we would have all these other elected officials like attorney general, controller, treasurer, an appointed Supreme Court. But later we'll change that to have an elected court system. Now there were some interesting provisions in there. Where did homestead protection and separate property for women come from? They're not English common law. Anybody guess?
Spain.
Spanish law. Now I'm going to take a short digression. Some of you heard me do this. Are we awake? Marginal, but we're working on it, right? Spanish law protected the rights of women far more effectively than did English law. English law was very, very patriarchal. Women had virtually no real property rights, etc. Spanish law did not. And that flies in the face of everything you might think you know. So where'd that come from? Well, let me ask you a question. Do you know how the modern nation of Spain was formed? It was the result of an arranged marriage between Catherine of Aragon and Ferdinand, Isabella of Aragon, and Ferdinand of Castile. And before she went into the arrangement, into the marriage, because she was the sole monarch of Aragon, she demanded what we today would call a prenuptial agreement. They would be co-regents, and she would have equal authority and equal power with Ferdinand. And that became a part of the law of Spain. Now, how many of you, when you were in public school, had somebody teach you that Isabella had to hawk her jewels in order to finance Columbus's voyage of exploration? Anybody heard that? You know, like back 50 years, 60 years ago, they used to teach that. Total bunk. It was a joint account. And the amount of money that she spent to finance Columbus's voyage of exploration was chump change. There is a gown in the Prada of Spain, the National Spanish Museum. It's one of Isabella's gowns. It has over 1,000 pearls sewn into the bodice. The gown itself was worth many, many times what the entire cost of Columbus's voyage of exploration was. And that was chump change for her. But it's amazing how these myths, like, you know, washing, tutting, cutting down the cherry tree, work their way into elementary school history books. Anyway, and we set up a permanent school fund, even though we didn't fund it. Well, when Texas secedes, the 1845 Constitution is just basically rewritten with some provisions for Confederacy. Public officials are required to support their pledge to the Confederacy. And Sam Houston, who had resigned as United States Senator, come back and run for governor of Texas, refused to sign the pledge and resigned as governor of Texas. It protected slavery, and it made freeing of slaves illegal. Off on a slight tangent for a second, how many of you are aware of the fact that there was a fairly significant body of freed slaves that lived in Galveston, had their own businesses, etc.? It's a very interesting history. And if you get a chance to go down to the Rosenberg Library, there is an excellent, or was, an excellent, up on the third or fourth floor, I forget which, survey on African Americans in Galveston. You owe it to yourself to go see it if it's still there. Well, it may not come as a surprise, but Texas did not fare real well in the Civil War. Didn't have the kinds of problems that Virginia, Georgia, and other states that were basically invaded heavily. But nonetheless, in 1866, Texas adopts a new constitution. Now, how many of you had American history? Do you remember the presidential reconstruction, which sought to bring the former Confederate states back into the Union with a minimum of fuss and trouble? So in 1866, Texas adopts this presidential reconstruction constitution. It's nothing but a rewrite of the 1845, 61, 66, they're all basically the same constitution. Institutions, machinery, powers, a few minor things like outlawed slavery, allowed slaves to own property, limited the rights of slaves in both court and at the ballot box. The 1866 congressional election, however, was an extremely significant election. The radical Republicans took control of Congress, and they just declared, they passed the Reconstruction Act in 1867, which just declared presidential reconstruction was null and void, that military government would be imposed on the South, and that a military governor would be appointed to run government in Texas until such time as there would be a new constitution adopted, and that ended up being the radical Republican Constitution of 1869. It's a fascinating constitution in many ways. The Constitutional Convention of 90 men met to draft a constitution but never actually adopted a final document. They ran out of money and all went home. So the military authorities collected up what they had done, edited it. Can I put a little air quote wrong there with edited it? Do I need to explain that? Kind of rewrote it, to be honest. And submitted it to the Congress, to the voters. Now, who could vote in July of 1869? No women.
Anyone who didn't support the Confederacy.
If you had not signed an oath to the Confederacy, or you were a freed slave. You think that was a big electorate? No. Believe it or not, the Germans of the Hill Country had been loyalist to the Union and had suffered during the Confederate period as a result, but they voted heavily for the 1869 Constitution, and the newly freed slaves voted heavily for it. So it was adopted by the voters, submitted to Congress, and in 1870 Texas is readmitted to the Union. The 1869 Constitution really sort of sticks out as a sore thumb of all state constitutions. Do I need to explain that? It called for an extremely strong governor who could appoint all the other officials, basically, all the judges, and gave him the executive authority to enforce edicts. That is to say, gubernatorial proclamations that carried the force of law. It called for annual sessions of the legislature and compulsory school attendance. Interestingly enough, that was a big sticking point. Por qué? At that particular point in time, you had lots of kids for what reason? Other than the fact that they didn't have birth control.
Cheap labor.
Well, you needed them to help with the farm. And do they need to be, I mean, after they've got to the point where they can read and write and do sums, do they need to go to school?
No.
A lot of people still feel that way. So compulsory school attendance was also a sticking point. Well, it shouldn't surprise you that ultimately, when former Confederates got the power to vote and run for office, they would seek to change the Constitution, and they did. Now, Governor Richard Coke, who had beat Edmund J. Davis for the power for the governorship, and I really would like for you to go, there's a very excellent Texas State Historical Association has a thing called the Handbook of Texas History, Handbook of Texas. It's available to you online for free. Just Google it, Handbook of Texas, Texas State Historical Association. And if there's any parts of Texas history that you want to follow up on, it's a good source. It's got a great search engine. You could type in Governor Edmund J. Davis. Yeah. What you got?
My girlfriend's car stopped.
Okay, check off. Yeah. Just type in Edmund J. Davis and look at him. I don't have a lot of time to cover the details. When I was your age and I was taking some Texas history, all the Texas history textbooks painted Edmund J. Davis like the second cousin of the devil incarnate. He was the bad guy big time. Historians now perhaps are a little less condemnatory. Looking at the situation that he faced, a very recalcitrant state that was trying to take away the powers of the newly freed slaves, he got a little high-handed, no question about it. So historians today are not quite sure how to deal with Hamilton. Yep, he was a strong Unionist, military. He'd been a Texan. He was a Texan before the Revolution, before the secession. Left, stayed loyal to the Union, was a Union general. Was he a little harsh? Yeah, no question about it. You have to ask the question, though, Miss Blackwater, would you have been a little harsh faced with the situation that he was faced with?
Probably.
How do you put down insurrection, almost, basically? Now, fascinatingly enough, the Constitutional Convention of 1876, elected 83 delegates, and the major faction of which were the Grange. And I find that it's very hard for students to really understand how the Grange could have had much of an impact on the Constitutional Convention, so I'll use a modern-day equivalent. They were the Tea Party of the 19th century. Not a majority, but a very strong voice. Now, they had an interesting goal. They wanted to restrict the scope and size of state government, but at the same time, they wanted to restrict the size and role of big business, especially the railroads and the banks. And in fact, the Constitution of 1876 outlawed banks. And that led to some interesting things here in Galveston, which later on we have time, so I'll talk about. Major features: popular sovereignty. The voters are going to vote on everything. Plural executive, part-time legislature, major separation of powers, not only between the branches, but within the branches. The way to check government power is to separate it out to the point where nobody has much of a hand on anything. We still stick with some of that. Very limited powers. When we talk about what the Constitution does, not only did it grant put the limits, it granted the power in extremely small doses. So every time the legislature of Texas starts to try to do something, we have to pass a constitutional amendment to give it power to do it. Placed multiple restrictions on the powers of government. So what are the weaknesses? Now wait a minute, why are we talking about the Constitution of 1876? Isn't this 2015? Yeah. Guess which constitution we're still operating under? Constitution of 1876, as amended multiple times. So what are the core weaknesses as we look at it? And by the way, this is not a liberal conservative issue. This is one in which there is general agreement among most individuals that it does fragment authority. And depending on which side of the boat you happen to be on which week, that's either good or bad. Fragments authority, executive branch and at the local governmental level. When we get to the study of local government in Texas, one of the banes of trying to get anything done at the local level is the extreme fragmentation of authority at the local level. There are more governments in Harris County than there are in the whole of Great Britain. Now, they're not of the same kind, but there are several thousand special districts that deal with issues like water, drainage, and so forth in Harris County alone. Excessive restrictions on both legislative and executive authority, and a lot of detail. Now, I can talk all day long about the degree of detail in the Constitution, and it's going to wash over you completely. So let me give you an example. This is one little section, section 49B from Article 3. Do you need to memorize it? No. We set up a Veterans Lend Fund, the purpose of which is to loan money to veterans who entered the service from Texas to help them be able to buy farms and later houses, no cars, thank you. Said Veterans Land Fund shall consist of any land heretofore and hereafter purchased by said board until the sale price therefore, together with any interest and penalties due having been received by said board, although nothing herein shall be construed to prevent said board from accepting full payment for any portion of any tract, and the monies attributable to any bonds heretofore and hereafter issued and sold by said board, which monies so attributable shall include, but shall not be limited to the proceeds from the issuance and sale of such bonds, the monies received from the sale or resale of such lands or rights therein, purchased with such proceeds, the monies received from the sale or resale of any lands or rights therein, purchased with other monies attributable to such bonds, the interest and penalties received from the sale or resale of such lands or rights therein, the bonuses, income, rents, royalties, and other pecuniary benefit received by said board from such lands, sums received by way of, there's a typo there, of indemnity or forfeiture for the failure of any bidder for the purchase of any such bonds to comply with his bid and accept or pay for such bonds, or for the failure of any bidder for the purchase of any lands comprising a part of said fund to comply with his bid and accept or pay for any such lands, and the interest received from the investments on any such monies, of any such monies. Did anybody notice one interesting thing about that whole section that I read? That's one sentence. I've often thought if I taught an English class and I had a particularly obstreperous group of people, I would ask them to diagram that sentence. That would be a task of Herculean. Could you translate that into real English? The board shall have the responsibility to determine how the monies used from the sale or resale of land shall be distributed.
That's it?
Well, that, you could put it into that. But why do we have this humongously long sentence?
So that way people won't read it?
We don't trust nobody. If there was a motto, if the Texas Constitution had a motto, it would be, don't trust nobody. Does that get in the way of doing effective government? Heck yeah! No question about it. Now, ever since I've been teaching this course, and that's a very long time, there's been discussion about how to revise the Constitution of the State of Texas, and there have been a number of efforts to do it. You could have a commission, which is an appointed body, works up a new constitution and submits the work to the legislature for the legislature to accept and forward to the people, which is then adopted by the voters. Most states recently that have sought to revise their constitutions have used commissions. But there's constitutional conventions in which you elect a body and they have plenary powers. Does everybody know what the word plenary powers means? They submit it directly to the voters. It doesn't go through the legislature. Or we can do it on a piecemeal basis in which we amend it section by section by section, and generally, as we'll see, the legislature is responsible for that. On the piecemeal basis, it takes a two-thirds vote of both houses of the Texas legislature to submit a proposed constitutional amendment, which is then advertised and goes to the voters for the voters to vote on it. It is adopted by a majority of the voters voting on the amendment. Now, I'm sure every one of you are aware that 5 weeks from now we are going to have an election. And we will be voting on a number of proposed constitutional amendments. For how many of you is that a absolutely first time I ever heard of it? Maybe with the exception of Ms. Sargent, the answer is Yeah. I'll give you a little cheat sheet on how to find the information on these these major amendments. Does anybody have any idea how many amendments we're going to be voting on? Let me give you a hint. It's about half as many amendments as were ever adopted to the U.S. Constitution. In one election a number of years back, we had 20-some-odd proposed constitutional amendments on the ballot. About 3% of the voters voted on it. Is that a good idea? I don't know. I could argue both ways. If 3% are the only ones who really gave a dang, maybe that's a good deal. But the other side of the coin is, are you comfortable with being governed by constitutional provisions that almost nobody knows who wrote them, why they wrote them, or who voted on them? And then the governor or the secretary of state proclaim they go into effect. Let the record reflect. When I say that, by the way, that means ears up. You know. Governor can't veto a proposed constitutional amendment. Okay? It's strictly a ministerial responsibility. It passed. And it doesn't make a rat's tail's worth of difference whether he really says it or not. The question is, did it get the votes? And I'll give you a quick little look at that. I didn't want to do it right now for the simple reason that I don't want people to waste their time trying to memorize a bunch of amendments. Fair enough? We'll look at it when we get closer to the election. Now, as of November 2013, well, now that was almost two years ago. Why do I use two-year-old data? Because that was the last time we voted on the constitutional amendments. The legislature had proposed 665 amendments, of which 483 have been adopted. Huh? 483? Can anybody rationally and reasonably be expected to know what was in 483 different amendments? Well, sometimes the amendments are amendments to amendments we've already made, which are amendments to amendments that had been previously made. Right. Well, remember I told you how restrictive some of these amendments are? Okay, moving on. The biggest effort to try to revise the Constitution took place between 1971 and 1975. And I want to spend a few seconds on that. By the way, I hope nobody will be terribly upset, but we'll probably get through a little early today. If that bothers you, I can go in and give you a bunch of these constitutional amendments. Now, this almost is a funny story in a way. When the legislature in 1971 met, it was full of a lot of new faces as a result of the redistricting that had occurred in 1965, and just a lot of new faces, one of whom was a senator from San Antonio by the name of Nelson Wolf. And he got totally frustrated with the Texas Constitution and said, you know, it's got to go. It's got to be a new one. So he proposed an amendment. Now, it's a complicated process. He proposed an amendment to the Texas Constitution, and that's proposed through a joint resolution, Senate Joint Resolution 67, which called for the establishment of a rather convoluted constitutional amendment process. I'll walk you through it. Am I going to necessarily expect you to memorize the details? It called for a constitutional commission to be established, which would make a recommendation to a constitutional convention, which would be made up of the members of the legislature. There's no state had ever tried one like that before, and promise you, nobody will ever try it again. So he proposed this thing in 1971, and At the time, there was a newspaper reporter here in Galveston by the name of Joel Kirkpatrick. I had gotten to know Joel pretty well. And he called me up and said, "Bujo," that's my nickname, "what's the chances of that amendment getting out of the legislature?" I said, "2/3 vote of both houses of the Texas legislature? I doubt it." They did. So it goes to the voters. Calls me up again. "Bujo, what do you think the chances of the voters adopting it?" "Well, I wouldn't place any bets on it." They did. Call for a constitutional commission to be appointed, and it did not have one person appointing the commission. It had 5 different individuals, each appointing individuals, and no limit on the size. So it ended up having 37 members. Another telephone call. "What do you think your chances," and it represented every sector of Texas public opinion, from the labor, FFL-CIO, to the Texas Association of Manufacturers, Texas Business Association, you know, everybody was on that commission or had a voice on it. "So what do you think the chances of the commission actually doing anything constructive?" "Joe, I'm not real sure about that." They did. Now, I'm beginning to learn that maybe making predictions, particularly making predictions that get published in the newspaper, is not smart. They appointed a young attorney by the name of Seth Searcy, and I have great respect for Seth Searcy. Would you like to guess why?
Why?
Because I had debated him in high school. I was on high school debate teams. I debated him in high school. And I learned that coming up against Seth Searcy was a good chance. I mean, I knew I was going to get beat. I just didn't know how bad. He was one of the most articulate, intelligent young guys I'd ever run across. And I didn't begrudge him. I just liked to be able to know that I had been able to make him work a little bit. I didn't think I was ever going to beat him, but I just make him work a little bit. He was given an impossible task: to propose to the Constitutional Commission, a proposed new constitution of about 10,000 words in length. The Texas Constitution is around 400,000 words long. I did not say in public, "I don't think he can do it," because damned if he didn't. Submitted it to the Constitutional Convention. Now, Texas did something no other state has done before or will probably ever do again. It declared that the legislature elected in 1973 would serve as the Constitutional Revision Commission. 181 members. They made great progress, but there was an inherent flaw. It was going to have to be submitted by a 2/3. The new proposed constitution would have to be submitted by a 2/3 vote. Now, really and truly, if when he was drafting the thing, Nelson Wolf had suggested only a majority was necessary, they probably would have submitted a new constitution. But the Constitutional Convention got off track, chasing rabbits, to be honest about it. Issues that really didn't make a rat's tail's worth of difference. The Texas Association of Business wanted a provision in the Texas Constitution which would have outlawed, which would have outlawed union agreements, a so-called right to work provision, and the unions fought it heavily. And the Texas Association of Business could muster about 1/3 of the votes who were would not vote for a constitution without the right to work provision, and labor could come up with about 1/3, a little over 1/3, who wouldn't vote for it under any conditions. So guess what finally happened? They never got 2/3. Now, the convention had chosen as its presiding officer Price Daniel Jr., who was Speaker of the House. I knew Price Daniel Jr. Now, the following comment, don't hold against me, please. I knew Price Daniel Sr. very, very well. In fact, on the night that Price Daniel Sr., in his effort to try to get elected the third time for governor of Texas, was beaten by John Conley, I was in the governor's mansion. I'd been very active in Price Daniel Sr.'s campaign, and I was there the night of the election. And his wife, Price Sr.'s wife, was the most lovely lady. She served everybody roast beef sandwiches and whatnot as we watched the results come in. And Zolly Stakely, who was Secretary of State, came in about 11 o'clock and said, "It's over. We're not going to win it." All right, back to the story at hand. I've often thought that Price Sr. should have demanded a paternity test to find out if Price Jr. really was his son, because he certainly wasn't a chip off of the old block. Maybe he was a chip, but not a very big chip. If you get an opportunity, read the political biography of Price Daniel Sr. He was elected to almost every major elected office you can be elected to in Texas. Governor, U.S. Senator, and Associate Justice of the Texas Supreme Court. Had a very long, very distinguished career. A man that you could look up to and be very proud of. At any rate, Price Jr. was a pretty inept leader. But I don't know whether it made any difference or not. The convention was so hung out over little minor issues that it didn't adopt a constitution. Well, let me tell you something. The voters were not, for most of the voters, were not really happy with the fact that they'd wasted 5 months and $10 million and come up with nothing. So everybody had a deathbed conversion and promised that in the elections of 1974, they would correct that mistake. And so in 1975, almost unanimously, the legislature proposed 8 amendments, the effect of which would have been to rewrite the Constitution. But now a fly in the ointment jumps up. Senator Peyton McKnight, East Texas, was hired to come up with a campaign to reject the Constitution. They had called a special election for August of 75. Now, what do you think the turnout's going to be in an August election? Very low. Again, the chairman of the Education Committee for the Constitutional Convention was a fellow by the name of Bob Gamage, Senator Bob Gamage. Bob was a personal friend of mine. Let me tell you a little story on that. The first year that I taught in college was 1963 at Sam Houston State. I shared an office with Bob Gamage. He and 3 other guys. He was married to, at that time, to a girl who had been in my church Sunday school group. So Bob and I got to be very fast friends, and he asked me if I would work with them to try to get the Constitution adopted. And I served as an unofficial advisor to the Education Committee of the Constitutional Convention Committee. And I think we did a dang good job on the educational article. Okay, I was asked to serve on a steering committee to help get the Constitution adopted. And we met in the Speaker's apartment in June of 1975 to come up with a plan. And I was sitting in the back of the room. Actually, to tell you the truth of the matter, that's where the Texas French Bakery had croissants, and I was back there scarfing some of those croissants. At that time, I weighed a lot more than I do now. I had not adopted a new lifestyle. At any rate, as they were asking these various people about how they're going to do it, say, "Well, we'll form speakers committees." And I thought, oh yeah, great. Who is going to show up and listen to somebody in the summer and do a speech on proposed constitution. We'll write letters to the editors. Blah, blah, blah. I thought, my God, I'm in a room full of political virgins. So it got to me, and I said, we'll come up with a dramatic issue. We're going to put out, tell them that if this constitution is adopted, their children, their daughters are going to run away with circus barkers. You know, come up with some sort of a really good, fanciful issue that people could identify with. And they all went, oh, we couldn't do that. That would be dishonest. And that's when I had the thought, I'm in a room full of political virgins. Well, they didn't do it. But Peyton McKnight and the group who were opposed to the Constitution did it. And they hit, I mean, this campaign for the mayorship in Houston strikes me as kind of interesting. They came up with a provision that the Constitution had a provision for unisex bathrooms, blah, blah, blah. There was nothing in the Constitution about bathrooms, for God's sakes. What it did call for was women's equal rights. Now, how you go from women's equal rights to we can't have separate sex bathrooms, I'm not sure. But they did. And they took out a bunch of ads and whatnot and saturated the state just before the election. And guess what? We got our rear kick 2-1. And so we're stuck with the present Constitution. However, there have been some efforts to try to deal with it since then. If you're going to get constitutional revision, you've got to have favorable public opinion, unified leadership, and a perception of a crisis. Well, we did have overall favorable public opinion going into the thing, but we did not have unified political leadership. The governor of the state of Texas, who was Dolph Briscoe at the time, came out in opposition to the Constitution. Now, during the course of the Constitutional Convention, he never said a mumbling word. He was asked for his views. Probably the most laid-back governor in the history of Texas. In fact, I almost have to do a test every morning to make sure he was still breathing. That's personal opinion identified as such. If somebody came out and said the governor's dead, they'd say, well, how could you tell? At any rate, he came out in opposition to it. Does anybody have any idea why Dolph Briscoe might have been opposed to the Constitution? Well, it was going to call some provisions in there which would call for very large chunks of land to be taxed at market value. And guess who happened to be the largest landowner in the state of Texas in 1975? Individual. Dolph Briscoe, the Briscoe Ranches, owned all or parts of about 5 counties in South Texas. Leadership was split all over the place. Media provided no strong leadership. In fact, every time somebody came up with an argument that if a dog barks, it's going to cause major problems, they'd put a headline on it. And then lastly, where was the perception of the crisis? Now, every state, I did a study of every state that had adopted a new constitution since World War II, and guess what was key to each one of those states that had adopted new constitutions? The voters saw some sort of a real reason to do it. In Michigan, the public schools were not going to be able to open in November, in September, because of the tax crisis. And Governor Romney rode that to getting a new constitution. In New Jersey, a similar kind of a problem. In Louisiana, just a few years ago, property taxes were going to double due to a defect in the Louisiana Constitution, and they managed to get the Constitution changed on that. So where was the perception of a crisis in Texas? Well, it was a negative one. All the bathrooms are going to be integrated, or something equally dumb. Constitutional Convention was the legislature, two-thirds rule, right-to-work issue, crummy leadership. And let me explain about cockroaches and revisionists. Has anybody ever walked into a dark room and flicked on the lights where there were some cockroaches?
Yes.
What do they do?
Scatter.
They scurry to get undercover, right? The cockroaches were the people who opposed the Constitution, but the moment you started putting a little light on them, they disappeared. The revisionists were the purists. I'm not sure which I hated more, the cockroaches or the revisionists. At least you could flip the lights on and know who the cockroaches were. The revisionists were the people who said, well, it doesn't go far enough, and if we reject this one, then we can get a better one. Now, the following comment is probably going to irritate some of you. Mostly those young ladies would follow me on this. When I was in high school, I had a very dear friend. She was on our debate team with us. And I don't know that she ever had a date. Not because she was ugly or dumb or any of those things, but she expected Prince Charming to suddenly come in and sweep her off her feet. And do I need to explain this? She never dated anybody because they weren't perfect enough. And after she died, I don't think she'd ever had a date in her life. She was looking for the perfect man. And the problem was they were looking for the perfect woman and she didn't qualify. I jokingly use that on myself. I was looking for the perfect woman and they were looking for the perfect man and I didn't qualify. All right, lots of discussions. Bottom line, it didn't go anywhere. Now, in recent years, we've had some efforts. Angelo State University came up with a project, and they proposed a new constitution for Texas. Well, I knew that that didn't have a chance of going anywhere because it was put together by academicians and students, and it didn't have any of the politics that of the compromises that are necessary to go anywhere. But it did produce a series of amendments to eliminate the deadwood and duplicate sections, which we adopted in two different elections, 1999 and 2001, which had the effect of taking about one-third of the Constitution and putting it in the trash can. We had duplicate sections. Believe it or not, we had duplicate sections in the Constitution that provided for exactly the same thing, but only slightly differently. So which one do you use? The one that was adopted most recently? The one that's most comprehensive? Makes for a lot of confusion. So where do we stand now? Well, no slide on this one. We have a constitution that's out of date. Pretty much the agreement on that. That has to be amended on a regular basis in order just to keep government functioning. That is everybody agrees, that it's obsolete. Let's put it that way. Everybody, regardless of where you sit, unless you have a vested interest in it, agrees that the property tax situation for funding schools in Texas is a total disaster. The Texas Supreme Court is probably going to rule sometime between now and December on the constitutionality of the present system. And there's pretty much the agreement that it will force the legislature to deal with it. But the legislature is in a heck of a box, folks. The Texas Constitution sets up the system that we're currently using, but at the same time requires that the state provide equal and effective funding for public schools. So you got one part of the Constitution that locks you into a system that the other part of the Constitution says is unconstitutional. What are you going to do? for the last 30 years, the legislature has basically thrown up its hands and gone, but we can't do anything. Is perhaps this the crisis that will ultimately lead to revising the Texas Constitution? I don't know. I'm almost hoping it is. I'd like to be able to end my Texas teaching career, teaching Texas history, by saying, thank God we got one problem solved. All right, we're going to review Wednesday and have the exam next Monday. Fair enough? Have a good one. I'll see you later. Can't keep you with the Texas.